Welcome to Law Talks. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Law Talks is a series of podcasts on international human rights law. It's produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative, which is part of the Open Society Foundations. Our guest for today's edition of Law Talks is James A. Goldston, the Executive Director of the Open Society Justice Initiative. Jim is going to be talking about public interest litigation, using national and international law to win court rulings that advance the cause of human rights. Jim.
Thank you. This is a brief introduction to public interest litigation from the perspective of a practitioner. And given the nature of this presentation, I won't purport to cover the topic comprehensively. Rather, I'm going to look in turn at four different issues. First, the definition of public interest litigation. Secondly, its main goals. Thirdly, its principal challenges. And finally, the ingredients of success. And of course, additional information and resources are available from the Open Society Justice Initiative, and people should certainly not hesitate to contact us. So first, let's begin with the question, what is public interest litigation? Public interest litigation is one phrase for a phenomenon that has been described with many different terms, whether human rights litigation, test case litigation, impact litigation, or strategic litigation. And by litigation, I'm referring to advocacy in courts before judicial officers and employing arguments grounded in law, statute, regulation, or judicial precedent. Now, what do we mean by public interest? In certain parts of the world which experienced communism, the notion of a public interest was quite novel. After all, the state was, by definition, the expression of the public's interest. No one else had the right or power to assert an alternative interest on behalf of the public. Though in less absolute terms, even democratically elected governments purport to act in the name of the public who elected them. In this sense, the notion of civil society actors, independent lawyers and clients, claiming to work in the interest of the public at large is contrarian, if not somewhat subversive. All that to say, public interest litigation in one form or another generally seeks to vindicate the legal rights of other persons beyond the named parties to a case. Now, what makes litigation strategic? Essentially, it's litigation that is consciously aimed at achieving a certain advocacy goal. In short, it's litigation that is not randomly chosen, but is the product of a thought or plan. Public interest litigation has been around for more than a century in some countries. In the United States, you cannot talk about it without referring to the landmark case of Brown versus Board of Education. Brown, the 1954 Supreme Court decision which famously outlawed racial segregation in American schools, is in many ways a paradigmatic example. Volumes have been written about Brown and what it means, but two things seem quite clear. First, Brown was a success. Second, Brown was a failure. Brown succeeded as a powerful declaration that African Americans would no longer be officially regarded as second-class citizens, but would be entitled formally to full and equal membership in the political community. By so prominently and unanimously deciding a question of such political significance, the Supreme Court in Brown changed public attitudes and public discourse, as well as public life, irrevocably and for the better. At the same time, Brown failed to end substandard schooling for many minority children. Even on its own terms, it failed to end segregation in the schools, which, though the law today bars it, continues and is worsening in many parts of the country. This duality of Brown, part success, part failure, is a reflection of the state of human rights litigation in many parts of the globe. Now, since Brown, public interest litigation has been used to address many other issues, from women's rights to environmental claims to economic and social rights, national security, freedom of expression, and access to information. So what are the goals of public interest litigation? First, litigants aim to secure a concrete, enforceable remedy for a breach of law. Remedies may consist of a number of things. One remedy is a judicial finding or declaration that certain provisions of law have been violated. This alone can have great importance for victims of abuse to have a court formally find and acknowledge that a legal wrong has been done. In this sense, the court's fact-finding function may serve some of the function played by truth commissions of officially endorsing a version of fact put forth by the victim and discrediting versions of fact propagated by perpetrators of abuse or their defenders. At the same time, it's important not to assume that a court and a truth commission have the same role. A court's fact-finding is necessarily limited to the scope of the legal dispute before it, and there will almost always be legal and practical reasons why the truth encompassed by a court's decision is partial and incomplete. Another remedy might be an order of compensation to the victim. Money is not an unimportant symbol of harm suffered. At the same time, to be sure, money alone cannot compensate fully for serious rights violations such as murder or torture or rape. The Russian government is now famous for complying with Strasbourg judgments that require payment to victims for breaches of the European Convention, but then doing very little, if anything, to reform its law or practice to prevent the recurrence of such abuses. This has given rise to concern that some governments may be effectively paying for the privilege of continuing to infringe human rights. Now, where a crime has been committed, another remedy might be an order to prosecute perpetrators of crime. Numerous court decisions have affirmed that where an individual raises an arguable claim that he's been seriously ill-treated by the police or other agents of the state, or a claim that the right to life has been breached, then international law requires that there must be an effective official investigation which must be capable of leading to the identification and punishment of those responsible. A second common goal of public interest litigation is law reform, a change in the law. In many judicial systems, this is achieved through the creation of judicial precedent, whether binding or merely persuasive. A court's ruling and accompanying reasoning may constitute a change in the way a legal norm, a statute, treaty, or regulation is understood and applied. Rulings by constitutional and supreme courts are often legally binding and carry political influence. Even in civil law systems, higher courts may be called upon to interpret or apply to a particular set of facts the broad protections contained in constitutional text and in some legislation. In some systems, a court ruling may result in a change of legislation through consequent parliamentary action. In addition to a remedy and change in the law, public interest litigation may be used to pursue broader objectives that do not necessarily require victory in the courtroom. A lawsuit based on a claim of public interest may foster public awareness about an issue, galvanize popular attention, or reinforce other means of spotlighting problems such as advocacy, monitoring, and research. The very process of articulating legal claims for court action may require a potentially transformative reframing of the question from one of history, social attitudes, or politics to one involving legal rights and remedies which judges have the possibility and the responsibility to address. Similarly to a human rights report, a court finding may shame a government or other party in a respected public forum. In some jurisdictions, the mere process of engaging in litigation may enable a claimant to secure additional facts necessary to expose injustice through interviews of witnesses, the use of a court's compulsory subpoena power, or other means. A lawsuit may complement and give added impetus to ongoing efforts at community organization. Even in losing cases, public interest litigation may preserve arguments for future generations to revive when a change in judiciary or legal culture creates a more receptive climate. There are numerous examples of cases that have lost in court but achieved success later or in other ways. Brown itself marked a vindication of what had once been a minority viewpoint. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harlan's lone dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson, the 1896 case which infamously entrenched racial segregation in America for another half century, is an example of arguments which remained buried in the casebooks until decades later they were relied upon by a new generation of judges to strike down segregation. In 1972, in the case of Laird v. Tatum, the Supreme Court dismissed for lack of ripeness a claim in which the plaintiff accused the U.S. Army of unlawful surveillance of citizen political activity. The court determined that the claim was speculative, as it was based on a fear that harm might result in the future from the Army's use of information acquired during the surveillance. The decision was a major loss in court, but the case provoked such a wave of public criticism that it led the Army to end the surveillance program. It also spawned a series of other lawsuits which successfully challenged the surveillance programs of local governments around the country. So even though Laird v. Tatum failed in court, it effectively closed a chapter on political surveillance in the United States until it was resurrected after 9/11. In Chile, during the 1970s and 80s, under the Pinochet dictatorship, the Vicariate of Solidaridad in the office of the Catholic Archbishop of Santiago filed numerous court actions seeking the whereabouts of disappeared persons or the release of prisoners. Although few of these secured judicial success, over time the lawsuits created a powerful record of torture and other abuses that acquired political importance in proving the extent of the Pinochet regime's rights violations. And after the end of Pinochet's rule, the Vicariate's work documenting repression contributed to the success of the National Commission on Truth and Reconciliation in exposing the truth about what had happened. In Nigeria, from shortly after independence in 1960 until 1999, a series of military regimes ran the country, alternating with brief periods of democratic rule. This was not an hospitable environment for litigation, and yet, in the late 1980s and 1990s, lawyers and NGOs used research and litigation together as a means of promoting rights awareness. Much of the litigation was hampered by interminable delays, by judicial apathy and corruption, and in many instances, the courts threw out cases or otherwise denied relief. Even on those occasions when the court ruled in favor of victims of abuse, the military authorities often ignored the rulings, and still, the cases focused a public spotlight on the injustices of the military regimes. Newspapers that did not dare report on a street demonstration would cover a court case and thereby give the reform effort needed publicity. While out-of-court advocacy often met with jail or worse, litigation became a somewhat more protected way to challenge unlawful practices. And finally, in certain environments, legal action may be considered fruitless. There's no point in pursuing it, some suggest, because the courts are corrupt or politically subservient. But many advocates of public interest litigation argue that the very bringing of a case may contribute to public support for the rule of law as such by demonstrating that legal remedies are possible. So understood, public interest litigation is an effort to strive by example to change the way that law is thought about and practiced. By acting as if the rule of law existed, as if judges were independent, as if cases were decided on the basis of facts and law rather than politics and influence, public interest litigation seeks to help make it so. So much for the goals. What about the challenges? Public interest litigation often has both grand and very concrete objectives, but they are, as we know, not very easy to achieve. Litigation is difficult, and one should give careful thought to whether other forms of advocacy are not more cost-effective. What are some of the constraints which must be taken into account in pursuing public interest litigation? First, it's slow. At national level, it can take 2 or 3 years or more to reach the highest instance court. At the international level, applications may be pending for several years more before bodies like the African Commission on Human and People's Rights or the European Court of Human Rights. Secondly, litigation is expensive. Gathering evidence and researching patterns of abuse, the kinds of facts that are needed for many public interest cases, cost money. Lawyers themselves don't come cheap. In many countries, the means for mitigating these costs are weak or non-existent. In many contexts, lawyers are notoriously reluctant to work pro bono for the public good. There may be bar association rules, which prevent lawyers from working for less than a minimum fee. Often, loser pay rules for cost allocations deter indigent plaintiffs from pursuing claims. Litigants thus bear the burden not only of their own costs for research and legal representation, but also those of their opponents. A victim of discrimination or police abuse is less likely to file a complaint if she risks losing her home or savings in the event she does not prevail. Legal aid is often underfunded for criminal cases, and it is simply not available for many of the civil actions employed in much public interest litigation. Beyond time and money, a third challenge is that litigation is by definition uncertain. You cannot know for sure the result before you engage. Litigation is not neutral. It may generate a negative result, which might leave your cause worse off than if you had not brought a legal action in the first place. Relatedly, public interest litigation is often aggressive and confrontational. It may well put you in an adversarial posture that may limit your options and narrow your pool of allies. Another problem is that precisely because public interest litigation is pursued for many different reasons, the interests of various parties to the litigation may not be the same. Individual clients may well have reason to settle for certain results, compensation, an individual apology, that may not satisfy a cooperating NGO that seeks a more systemic result. managing those competing interests can be hard. In many countries, rules of procedure do not allow for the consolidation of claims into class actions or the like. A court will generally entertain only the claims of those claimants named in the action before it. Many court systems do not provide for the kinds of equitable remedies that have proven so useful to public interest litigation, whether in order to enjoin or stop a certain practice, or the full-scale assumption of court supervision of the operation of an institution like a school or a prison. Legal and judicial culture often poses another obstacle. Many judges are reluctant or not accustomed to consider statistical or other empirical evidence, which is often precisely the kind of proof needed to prove a public interest litigation claim. Capacity, too, is an issue to be considered. In many cases, judges often have little capacity to enforce any judgment they may issue. The judiciary is, in Alexander Bickel's famous term, the least dangerous branch of government. It has the power of neither the sword nor the purse. A final challenge is capacity and competence. There is a great need to build the skills and knowledge of lawyers and NGOs to pursue legally and factually complex cases involving multiple plaintiffs. In light of the many goals of public interest litigation and the significant challenges, what as a practical matter are the ingredients of success? What are the main issues that prospective lawyers, NGOs, and claimants should consider in maximizing the likelihood that their efforts yield positive results? First, as in many spheres of life, do no harm. Don't litigate if you don't have to. Like war, litigation should be a weapon of last resort. If you can achieve what you want through other means, negotiation, education, lobbying, it may be quicker and less expensive. Second, even once you decide to litigate, remember, public interest litigation is only one of many tools to bring about change. It is best pursued not in a vacuum, but in close coordination with other tactics. These may include lobbying for legislative reform, direct action or street demonstrations or petitions, and mobilizing political leadership. Two other tools often used in conjunction with litigation bear consideration: using the media and working with affected communities. Judicial decisions have enhanced impact if people know about them and understand their significance. Explaining to the media why a ruling matters, what its implications are for others, and how the government can comply in a reasonable manner may be crucial to securing public acceptance and support. Framing the discussion in a manner which is most compelling is crucial. Most cases raise multiple legal claims, and how the case is understood, not just by judges, but by the public at large, may be affected by which of the claims is given priority. To give an example, in a case involving racial segregation in public education in Europe, a major question was what was the major issue in the case. The plaintiffs wanted the court to focus on discrimination against Roma children, since the case law had previously made clear that racial discrimination is almost never justifiable. By contrast, the government sought to characterize the case as about educational policy, for which the jurisprudence traditionally grants a wide margin of appreciation. In finding for the plaintiffs in the resulting landmark judgment, D.H. versus Czech Republic, the European Court made clear that racial discrimination lay at the heart of the case. Given the length of litigation, it's often important to use different stages: a hearing, the filing of an application, a lower court decision that will be appealed, as an opportunity for media outreach. In this way, even if the end result is less than optimal, the litigation will have provided a number of opportunities for raising awareness of the issue as it proceeds. Another tool is relations with affected communities. A public interest litigation strategy, designed and pursued in collaboration with affected communities, will generally have more durability and impact. NGOs and issue-oriented activists have time and energy that lawyers often lack to devote to public education about particular cases. Timing litigation to coincide with other activities outside the courtroom, like the publication of a report, the introduction of a bill in the legislature, or the convening of a public hearing, may help focus public attention on a case in a beneficial way. And when a case is decided, it will often be affected communities of non-lawyers who have the interest and perseverance to ensure that the judgment is not forgotten. So those are just some of the tools to be deployed in conjunction with litigation. Another factor to consider in maximizing the success of public interest litigation is coordination and information sharing. In many areas of public interest law, multiple organizations with similar aims work. Insufficient sharing of information and coordination of activity risks not just duplication of resources, but the launch of insufficiently compelling, or worse yet, conflicting cases, each of which may damage the other. What else contributes to public interest litigation's success? Use legal doctrine creatively. This advice applies in several ways. First, in the absence of clear legal rules expressly governing the conduct at issue, it may be necessary to argue that more general provisions, which may not previously have been considered, apply. In the DH case, when at the time there was no domestic legislation expressly outlawing racial discrimination, the claimants relied on a general provision of the Civil Code prohibiting interference with human dignity, though no one had ever previously thought that relevant to Roma. Second, precedent. Even in a jurisdiction that does not treat court rulings as legally binding, it may be possible to rely on the persuasive force of a decision's reasoning in maximizing its significance in other settings. Judges are human beings, too. The mere power of analogy as a form of human reasoning may guide one judge to look at what others have said on similar questions. Third, even where court rules do not provide for collective remedies through class action, it may be possible and desirable to join together the complaints of several similarly situated individuals into one legal action. In the event of protracted litigation, joinder may guard against the risk that one or more complainants drops out. It may also lay a foundation for presenting evidence of systemic as opposed to individual harm. Fourth, find ways to use more favorable doctrine in one area to support your argument in another. For a long time in Europe, gender discrimination law was more developed than race discrimination law, in part because data broken down along gender lines have historically been more available and less controversial than ethnic data. So in pursuing litigation and law reform to challenge ethnic discrimination, a number of advocates quite rightly drew upon doctrines previously established in the gender jurisprudence, for example, the reversal of the burden of proof to ease the burden on victims of discrimination. What else contributes to success? Offer constructive solutions and remedies. When you go to court to challenge a problem, you are far more likely to succeed if you propose a solution that is not only required by law, but seems reasonable, politically workable, and institutionally manageable. Judges are likely to take account of what is logistically and administratively possible in fashioning a remedy. So you do well in trying to give your adversary and the court a proposal they cannot ignore. That will also be more likely to make your arguments persuasive in the court of public opinion, whatever the judge decides. This is easier in some cases than in others. In a single case of torture, the remedy is relatively clear: a finding of a violation, victim compensation, and prosecution of those responsible. But in a case challenging a pattern and practice of police misconduct, the entire police force behavior may be at issue. The changes required may be more far-reaching, and it will be more challenging, though nonetheless essential, to fashion a remedy that is both appropriate and feasible. Another key to success is implementation. It's never too early to think about implementation. Long before a case is launched, it's important to consider how it will be implemented in the event that there is a favorable judgment. This involves crafting the proposed remedy in a manner that it can be readily monitored and enforced, reserving resources for follow-up activities, and building alliances during the course of the litigation to pursue implementation after judgment. A final suggestion I would offer is be realistic, manage your expectations and those of your clients and partners, but at the same time, don't be afraid to expect a lot. Litigation won't change the world all by itself, but it can have a big impact.
That was James A. Goldston, the Executive Director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, talking about public interest litigation. The Justice Initiative is involved in more than 50 cases of human rights litigation around the world. You're listening to Law Talks, the podcast about international human rights law. Law Talks is produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative. To learn more about our work in international human rights, visit justiceinitiative.org, our website. That's justiceinitiative.org. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Thanks for listening.